about some of our own attempts to explore cosmic singularities and how they might be resolved. So let me just remind you of the big puzzles in cosmology. Some of them relate to the geometry of the universe. And of course, the biggest, which you don't have to be a cosmologist to appreciate, is that the universe began in a singularity. And the general public understand the importance of this question, even if professional cosmologists try sometimes to sweep it under the rug. But it's there staring us in the face, and we can literally see it in our past. If we detect gravitational waves, which I saw Alessandro was giving a beautiful lecture on earlier today, but if we can detect these waves, which should happen quite soon, then over the next few decades, we can use gravitational waves to look right back to the singularity. They go straight through the plasma of the early universe and show us what happened at the singularity. So this is not a philosophical question. It's a question which can be answered by theory and observation. Singularity is the big puzzle in the geometry. And there are other puzzles, like why today's universe is so flat, isotropic, the horizon puzzle, I'm sure you all know about, and the perturbations, why the universe is not completely uniform. Of course, these puzzles are the classic successes of inflation, the classic, inflation was invented to solve the first three puzzles and then semi-miraculously managed to solve the fourth as well, provided a solution for the fourth, and I think that convinced many people that inflation was probably correct. But I'm going to question that in the spirit of perimeter. And emphasize the other puzzle that was not solved by inflation, and a few other puzzles. So the matter in the universe is also a puzzle. The universe is not empty, and this may sound a slightly a weird point to make, but the universe is not empty. It's full of stuff. And in fact, in some of the theories I'll describe for the, quote, beginning of the universe, this is a big problem, because the theories predict the most probable universe to be completely empty. But the universe is not empty. We have radiation. We have baryonic matter. We have dark matter, which is, of course, a huge puzzle. And we have dark energy. And then I would say there is a puzzle about the future. And in some ways, it's equally puzzling as the past. If the cosmological constant really is constant and dominates into the future, then we're heading for a pretty bleak universe. The galaxies will fly apart, all the lights will go out in the sky, and it's a pretty depressing place to be. But there's another puzzle which is in the in many theories that isn't the end, actually. What happens is that the cosmological constant is not stable. It will decay. And so you'll go into a phase of negative cosmological constant, and then you will hit a singularity. Okay? And so the presence of future singularities is very generic in the kind of theories we have today. So there are a number of puzzles here in the matter. The big one that is always emphasized is why is the density of dark energy or lambda so tiny, 10 to the minus 120, m Planck to the fourth. And this sort of appears most dramatic if you sketch a graph of the log of the density against the log of the time. And of course, radiation falls off like scale factor to the minus 4. The dark matter and the baryonic matter fall off like a to the minus 3. So that would be radiation, dark matter, baryonic matter. And then there's just a tiny, tiny amount of dark energy, which is completely irrelevant at early times, but non-zero. And so just yesterday, this dark energy took over. And here we are today with rho lambda equal to 70% of the total. So if you take the point of view that something or someone started off the universe here, they had to do a pretty careful balancing act. I mean, they had to put in a huge ton of radiation, a lot less dark matter and baryonic matter, and then they had to put in almost nothing in lambda. And so these initial conditions are really peculiar. Peculiar initial conditions. And they're so peculiar that people like Lenny Susskind have actually argued that, in a way, this is the end of predictive science. I mean, this is such a bad problem that people say, maybe this is a quantity we will never be able to understand. And then you resort to the anthropic principle and other arguments. And so the type of sort of mathematically precise predictions we're all aspiring to as theoretical physicists is in danger of being thrown out the window at this point, because this is such a bizarre problem. So I'm going to propose one equally bizarre solution to that problem, okay? And the solution will be that actually the Big Bang wasn't the beginning. There was time before the Big Bang, and there was another universe, and I'll try to explain how that can resolve these apparently very strange initial conditions. So when you deal with all this, there are basically two options regarding the singularity. That one, the singularity was the beginning, or some smoothed out version. Was the beginning. Okay, and that is implicitly what most people believe. In fact, Stephen Hawking, if you read his articles, he even claims at various points to prove it was the beginning. But it's not a proof at all. All that Hawking and Penrose proved these wonderful theorems, but they just prove that general relativity fails at that point. And they certainly do not prove that the singularity was the beginning. And in fact, recently, Roger Penrose has been propagating a cyclical picture of the universe, rather similar in spirit, at least, to what I'll talk about. And option two is very simple, that there is just a not in the sentence. It's just a yes or no question. Was the singularity the beginning or not? So let me now talk about option one and raise, I've lost the eraser. Actually, before I do that, let me just mention that in addition to these puzzles, there are other theory-generated puzzles, one of which is the landscape problem, which is that string theory, as currently understood, seems to have a huge number of different compactifications of the extra dimensions. And so basically, the laws of particle physics, which are determined by that compactification, seem to have this huge number, perhaps 10 to the 1,000, or even infinity, possible forms. And again, if you take the view that singularity was the beginning, that is very, very hard to understand. You have to somehow picture a mechanism picking these compactifications at random at the beginning, and then you're sort of stuck with that for the history of the universe. So there's no physical evolution of those quantities. It's a choice, that it's a discrete set of discrete choice that has to be made at the beginning, and how or why that choice was made is something which people don't deal with, and which in fact you can't deal with if you don't resolve the singularity. Especially within string theory, giving up on solving the singularity is actually giving up on predictivity in a huge way. It's giving up on predicting the laws of physics. So let me talk about option one. With option one, if the singularity was the beginning, then as far as we can tell, we need to have a period of inflation. And so what is inflation? I'm not sure if you've had some lectures already, but you probably, most of you, know what inflation is. Is that a safe assumption? Yes, nobody's saying, no, I've never heard of it. Okay. At least some people know what inflation is. So we need to have inflation. Now, the basic idea, the physical picture of inflation, is that you had some inhomogeneous little patch of the universe, and you also had a temporary cosmological constant. You had some scalar field with potential energy, which was huge and behaved like a, so here is my V of phi, and I have my inflaton field. And for some reason, this field was large just after the singularity. You don't deal with the singularity, you deal with just after the singularity. And you assume that this field was up here. So there was a lot of vacuum energy, and then just like the dark energy does today, though in vastly greater quantity, it causes the universe to expand exponentially. And so this needs a lambda effective or a temporary cosmological constant of around, it's somewhat model dependent, but in the simplest models, it's something like 10 to the minus 5 M Planck to the fourth. So this is how inflation works. It expands the universe exponentially. That exponential expansion makes the universe flat, isotropic, homogeneous, and as I'll explain in a moment, also generates the density variations. But there's an ugly feature of this, which is that the minimum of the potential here has to be non-zero and positive. And there's your 10 to the minus 120 M Planck to the fourth, just to fit the observations of dark energy today. So any model you write down which has some potential for some field or set of fields inevitably has this horrendous tuning problem, that this potential is capable of generating vast cosmological constants, and yet the minimum is so small for unexplained reasons. Secondly, you've got to explain why this guy started up the hill, and the only explanation is this one. and that's somewhat unsatisfactory. I want to point out a further problem, which I'm not sure everybody appreciates, which is that this picture is actually very naive, of taking a little piece of space and blowing it up exponentially. The point is that the metric in inflation looks like this. That's the space-time metric. And so you're just taking space and blowing it up exponentially. That looks exactly like this picture. Okay, but GR is a subtle theory. And the consequence of this expansion, you see, let me start off with a particle living in this inflating universe. And imagine that it's not exactly at rest with respect to the co-moving coordinates. It has some small velocity with respect to the expanding universe, some peculiar velocity. So it has some momentum. And the point is, if I take that particle and trace it back in time, that momentum is proportional to the it goes like 1 over the de Broglie wavelength. Okay, that's just the quantum mechanical behavior, that the momentum of a quantum particle is h bar over lambda. And the de Broglie wavelength, of course, grows with the scale factor, or shrinks if I'm going backwards in time. So lambda is proportional to 1 over a of t. So if you just solve the geodesic equation for a particle in an inflating universe, you'll find its momentum diverges as you go back in time. And what does that mean? Well, it goes to infinity as t goes to minus infinity. So as the time goes to minus infinity, if you like, tracing inflation all the way back, the momentum of my particle goes to infinity. And what does that mean? Well, that means that if its momentum is infinity, its trajectory is null. It means it goes up to the speed of light. And so your particle is actually following a null trajectory. And so if I follow the particle backwards, it has some small velocity. And eventually, so if this is time and that's space, eventually it will be, this is physical space, eventually it will be going at the speed of light. And so it turns out that you actually hit this, you hit t, this is t equals minus infinity. I've squashed the diagram. But you hit t equals minus infinity in a finite time. You don't hit it at negative infinity time. You hit it at a finite time. And of course, if you have a picture like this, it's a massive particle. And so I can always go to the rest frame of the particle. And in fact, the space-time looks like this. Space-time picture of inflation. So this is a causal diagram, Penrose diagram. So this is a diagram which shrinks the space-time to a finite size while maintaining the causal structure of it. The causal structure of inflating space-time looks like a cylinder. And this surface is t equals plus infinity. And the t equals minus infinity is actually this line. Okay, so if I followed the particles, if I followed particles back in these coordinates that were stationary in those coordinates, they would just hit the surface in a finite proper time. And that's what this is reflecting. So actually, the coordinates are incomplete. These coordinates are incomplete. They do not cover the whole space-time. They only cover half of it. So inflation is half of the space-time. And the other half, not too surprisingly, is deflation. Okay. And so this inflation picture is incomplete. It's not that it starts at minus infinity and continues measured in the time which particles would actually measure the inflating space-time is, the technical term, is passed geodesically incomplete. Okay, so so this means that there are geodesics which hit the edge of the space-time in a finite time. And that, in fact, is the definition. Sorry. Geodesically. That's the definition of a singular space-time. People have worried about the definition of singularities. What is a singularity in GR? And some definitions are you get infinite curvature or other kinds of pathologies. But after a great deal of discussion, that is the definition which people converged on. So this inflating space-time certainly starts with a singularity. Now that's a bit worrying, because let us take this picture of compactified extra dimensions, for example. Okay? So I will pick one compactification. I've got to define the data on this surface. It's an infinite surface, it's null. Okay? And I have to specify some data on that surface. So I could pick one compactification down here. I could pick another compactification up here. I could pick another compactification over there. Okay? I'm allowed to do that, because there's supposed to be a landscape of possible compactifications. So let me just sprinkle the landscape along that surface. Okay? And what will happen? It's a total disaster. Okay? Because even though this one might generate inflation, and let's say it lasted up till here, so I might generate a nice, so this would be nice. This would be inflating. Okay, but over here is waiting, a disaster is just waiting for you. And what will happen is that this disaster will propagate across the space-time at the speed of light and destroy you. And unfortunately, if you don't specify the data here, you can't say that's not going to happen. This is an extreme version of an argument known as persistence of memory in inflation. Okay, the persistence of memory argument, due to Garriga, Vilenkin, Guth, and others, in fact, when you look at it, assumes perfect boundary conditions on that surface, okay, then has bubbles nucleating within the space-time. And then they discover that even in the far future, the fact that the initial conditions break de Sitter invariance is reflected in the statistical distribution of bubble collisions in the far future. And so they found, to their surprise, you know, inflation is supposed to wash out all the memory of initial conditions. That was the reason inflation was invented, so that whatever the initial conditions, you'd get the same kind of universe coming out. But in these explicit calculations with bubbles, that is shown not to be true. And I would say there's a far worse problem, which is that you know, this is persistence of memory in an extreme form. If I put some garbage in the initial condition, the garbage will kill the whole inflating space-time later on. So what does this mean? It means that either I have to specify very homogeneous, smooth, you know, single compactification initial conditions across the whole space-time, or I have to explain, you know, why I was lucky and I didn't see the garbage. So that sort of makes you nervous, that actually you have to pick special initial conditions for inflation to make it work. So now let me talk a little bit about the perturbations. Just check the time. So as I mentioned, the sort of huge success, go ahead. the bubbles, sorry, here, it depends on parameters, but so when you nucleate bubbles, in general, if you have a first order phase transition, then in an inflating spacetime, in general, the bubbles do not percolate. The space is expanding so fast that they never fully cover the whole spacetime. But what happens is that they, even though they don't cover the whole spacetime, any given bubble becomes hit by an infinite number of other bubbles. Okay, because you have one big bubble and you can always nucleate an infinite number of bubbles out here and they will collide with you. So there's no such thing as an isolated bubble. On the? Yes, it does. So typically it's small because bubble nucleation is usually exponentially suppressed. And when it's small, then the bubbles do not fill the whole space-time. They do not percolate. But nevertheless, each bubble gets hit by an infinite number of other bubbles, but they still do not fill the whole space-time. Yes. What? Oh, well, the bubbles are moving at the speed of light. So this is a causal diagram. So in a causal diagram, as I said, you bring infinity in time down to a finite patch, to a finite location. And then you can just draw a bubble just looks like a triangle with a 90-degree angle. And so the bubbles are just thrown down randomly in this space-time, and then you can just see if they collide. So you're worried that the space is going exponentially, so how does, well, nothing goes faster than light, so. This is a problem in general relativity, so it'll take me a little while to derive it. But the bubbles can certainly collide. And they do. It's just that they don't fill the space because it's expanding exponentially. But it's different than bubbles in Minkowski space, flat space. Okay, so let's talk about perturbations. And as I explained, this is really a feature of inflation that was very compelling. When it was discovered that inflation gives you quantum fluctuations sort of as the origin of density perturbations, that was found very compelling as an argument in favor of inflation. And all I want to emphasize is that the reason we get the right kind of perturbations from inflation is due to symmetry. Okay, the origin of scale, so the perturbations we see are approximately scale invariant. That's their character. See, sometimes people show this graph, and they say, that's evidence for inflation. You may have seen that. Now, that graph has nothing to do with inflation. This graph is due to plasma physics. Okay, this is plasma physics. That's what causes the oscillations. The input from inflation is simply that the power spectrum is scale invariant. Pk goes like k to the n, and n is approximately 1. Okay, so almost the entire input inflation is just to have that number equal to 1. Okay, so inflation gives the right answer because it somehow generates scale invariant fluctuations. And I just want to emphasize the origin of these is, in essence, due to a symmetry of an inflationary spacetime. And then I want to point to other mechanisms, also based on symmetry, which can give the same result. So I want to try to convince you that the inflationary explanation is not necessarily the only possible explanation. So let's look at inflation and where it comes from. So we have some scalar field with a potential. And the important thing is that this potential is very nearly flat. Okay, it's a very gentle potential. And so the scalar field will roll very, very slowly. So to see the essence of inflation, in fact, let's take the limit where the potential is exactly flat. Okay, just pretend the potential is flat. Then the scalar field is a massless scalar field. And because of this vacuum energy, it lives in De Sitter space. It lives in a perfect exponentially expanding universe with metric given by that. So it's convenient to rewrite this as by defining a new variable, let's say dt over e to the ht equals dtor. So the point of this is that the metric now becomes e to the 2ht minus dtor squared plus dx squared. And if you solve this equation for tor, you'll find this is just 1 over h squared tor squared times minus dtor squared plus dx squared. Okay, so in fact, this is just going to conformal coordinates where the metric is Minkowski multiplied by a scale by this 1 over tor squared. And the tor here actually goes from minus infinity to 0 as t goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So let's look at the action for the inflaton field. And I'm just going to do this in very crude fashion and pretend that it's a massless scalar field. So the fluctuations in the inflaton are a massless field. So I'm saying phi is equal to some rolling field plus delta phi. And I'm just going to treat this delta phi as if it was actually a massless field. Now, if I take that metric and plug it into here, I get y over h bar Hubble constant squared is integral, and then delta phi dot squared minus grad delta phi squared all over tor squared dtor d3x. Okay, so that's the action for a scalar field in a De Sitter spacetime. And they're just two. To get scale invariant perturbations, what you need is two things. First of all, you need some kind of instability. Because you've got to convert quantum fluctuations, which are almost, which are typically tiny, into big classical perturbations. So you have to have some kind of instability. And second of all, you need a symmetry. You need scale symmetry. So if you have some mechanism with scale symmetry that has an instability, then it has a good chance of generating scale invariant perturbations. So in the inflationary case, the instability is extremely simple. Okay? The instability doesn't really look like an instability, but if delta phi is a constant. If you just take a massless field and I shift it by a constant, I've changed the system, right? And the thing is, in an expanding universe, the scalar field is damped. So if I take a scalar field and I shift it a little bit, then the gradients won't be able to pull it back because the motion of the field is damped. And that's basically the instability, that as inflation proceeds, the inflaton field is kicked backwards and forwards. There's no restoring force, except the gradients, but they're negligible compared to the damping from the expansion. And so you kick around the field, and you generate this classical long wavelength density perturbation. So that's the symmetry. That is the instability. the symmetry is very trivial. If I look at this action and I just rescale time and space, then the action is invariant. Okay, because there are four powers up here, two powers there, and two derivatives. So the action is scale invariant. But that means if I go and compute the expectation value of delta phi squared, the variance in the field in real space, this has to be proportional to h bar because it's a quantum effect. And you can see that in the action, h bar always comes with h squared anyway. And so this is going to be proportional to h bar times h squared. It's got to be an integral over all the Fourier modes, because you have to add them all up. And it's got to be constant. Delta phi has to be constant. That's the instability. Okay? So your perturbation you generated quantum mechanically is constant in time. The answer cannot depend on tau. There's no possible tau dependence. So the only thing, you've got to make up something here with the right dimensions that only depends on k, on space, and so it's got to be k cubed. Okay, so that is the way in which the symmetry, the scale symmetry of de Sitter space gives you a scale invariant spectrum of scalar field. And this scalar field translates directly into the scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations that you see from inflation. Now, there are lots of sort of technicalities in doing that, picking a gauge, including gravitational back reaction, et cetera, et cetera. But that is the essence of the mechanism of inflationary perturbations. So it's clear that if you want to generate, well, two things are clear. One is that inflation, we're not really getting hugely detailed information here with this power spectrum. We're getting one spectral index. I mean, obviously, there are other things. The spectral index can run slowly. That's a small effect. You can have non-Gaussianity, another small effect. Okay, but the booming signal, the scale invariance, is essentially one number, and its origin is due to a simple scale symmetry in the theory. So if you want to reproduce that success, that's what you've got to do. You've got to make a theory which has some instability and some scale invariance, some reason for scale invariance. Okay, so now I'm going to go on to option two, that the Big Bang was not the beginning. But maybe if there are any questions about option one. Okay? So let's now assume the Big Bang was not the beginning. Let us look again at one of these causal diagrams, Penrose diagram. So you can write the metric like this. If you're dealing with a flat metric, and then it's to a causal diagram, you just do that same trick of defining detour to be dt over a, and then I get this metric. And in that metric, I can see exactly the light always travels at 45 degrees. So here's the singularity in a standard Big Bang, no inflation. In that case, it's space-like. It's not null. In inflation, it was null. But in the standard cosmology with just radiation, the singularity is space-like. And now, as I look back along my past light cone, I can see the singularity. So a very obvious idea is the following, that you see the singularity only appears in the conformal factor of the metric. Okay, it's because, how do I even know there's a singularity there? The singularity is the place where A goes to zero. But many types of fields and particles are conformally coupled in general relativity, okay, classically. Okay, but photons and Dirac fermions, if they're massless. Are conformally coupled. And what that means is they actually don't see this factor at all. Okay, a photon is not really aware the universe is expanding. Sounds peculiar, but equations of motion of Maxwell's equations are conformally invariant, and the effect of the conformal factor can be just removed by scaling the field variables. The only reason we know the universe is expanding is because massive particles emit photons, which are then received by other massive particles. So massless particles, which are conformally coupled, don't see the expansion. So one very primitive idea would be to say, well, the singularity is a bit of a fiction, providing that at very high temperatures and energies, everything is conformally coupled. Okay? And this is not true, but it's not a bad approximation, because as you go to high energies, symmetries are restored in general, like electroweak symmetry. Particles lose their mass, and indeed, the particles that are around in a grand unified theory are basically conformally coupled. If that's the case, you can actually just throw this out, because it doesn't enter into the field equations. So you could just trace back these particles before the singularity. So as I said, that's an extremely crude idea. It's not an original idea. I think lots of people realize this. But it makes you think, was there a universe before? And that's the essence of the ekparotic scenario. Cyclic scenario, etc. So these involve the idea that actually the singularity wasn't the beginning, that in fact there was some physics which went on at the singularity, which in some way made the particles insensitive to this conformal zero of the scale factor. And there was a universe before. Yeah. Yes. There are anomalies. So conformal symmetry is not an exact symmetry, even in electrodynamics. Quantum effects break that symmetry. But nevertheless, you can take it as a clue. The fact that classically there is a symmetry, maybe I wouldn't say it any stronger than that. That there's a sort of hint that at high energies, there's certainly more conformal symmetry at high energies than at low energies. So it's going in the right direction, even if it's not enough to get rid of the singularity. So the ekparotic scenario, I'll just summarize very simply. The first point is that obviously if there's a universe before the Big Bang, there's no horizon problem. Because there's a whole lot of physics down here which can correlate the photons coming to us from two parts of the sky, and so the horizon problem disappears very easily. But what about the other problems? Flatness, perturbations, etc. And so this is the ekparotic idea, which Jean-Luc will be lecturing about. And Justin, of course, was one of the inventors of this scenario. And it's an extremely simple idea, a bit like inflation, which is capable of solving all those inflationary puzzles, but in a completely different fashion. So in the ekparotic scenario, the idea is that your scalar potential isn't positive. It should actually look something like this. We live here today, okay, or actually I should say the universe, I'm already talking cyclic, but without cyclic, let's imagine the universe before the Big Bang was up here in some phase like this at, it could be positive potential energy, doesn't have to be. But then the potential takes this form, minus V naught E to the minus C phi. Okay, and that's only an approximate form. Basically, this is saying the potential falls steeply as you go to, as phi decreases. And any potential of roughly that form will give roughly the same answer. So there's a very broad class of potentials which fall very steeply, but it's the opposite of inflation. Inflation, you want very shallow potentials. Here, you want very steep potentials. If you have a potential like this, you can solve the Einstein equations, and what you find is the scale factor goes like a goes like t to the p, just a scaling solution of the Einstein equations. In fact, it scales because of a scale symmetry, which I'll explain in a moment, with p equal to 2 over c squared. And we're going to want c to be much bigger than 1. I'll put a Planck mass in here. Okay, so you need a potential that's very steep in Planck mass units for the scalar field. Then the scale factor goes like this. And so the density goes like 1 over t squared, because the density is always a dot over a squared in the Friedman, from the Friedman equation. But a is a power law, so this is always 1 over t squared. Yep. Sorry? You don't understand why? Oh, if you're conformally coupled. So conformal coupling means there is a symmetry of the action, that if I take the metric g mu nu, if g mu nu goes to omega squared of x times g mu nu, that's a conformal transformation. Okay? And if I take the fields, for example, fermion field, I think goes to omega to the minus of half of x psi, then that's actually a symmetry of the action. And the gauge field, I think, goes to omega minus 1 a mu. So these are symmetries. So this is simply a symmetry of the action if they're conformally coupled. And so when I have a metric with a non-trivial conformal factor, I just rescale it away using this. So just pick omega to be 1 over a, and then it's gone. Yes, so I mean, a has a 0. So typically, for example, in a radiation-dominated era, a goes like tau. So a has a 0. So you see general relativity fails here because the metric vanishes. Okay, but what this is saying is that you can actually just scale that away. So what you would say, if this was true, if all the fields really were conformally coupled, we would say that this metric was a bad choice of coordinates on configuration space, on the configuration space of fields. And so you'd pick a better choice of coordinates where the metric does not vanish, and then it's the same theory, actually. And so then you just follow that through the singularity. So if there was perfect conformal symmetry, then there would literally be nothing at the singularity. So maybe to answer Sumit's question, we have to break conformal symmetry to get a bang. And that's what makes the bang, is the breaking of conformal symmetry. Otherwise, it would just be whatever was before would just come straight through, and there would be nothing there at all. So that'll be a sort of repeated. Could you keep it later, because I'm just worried about time. Is that okay? What's the time constraint? Okay, then I'll take the question. Well, you see, the curvature is not conformal invariant. So R goes over to something, which I've forgotten, but it will be something like this, plus omega to the minus 2 box omega. So R is not conformally invariant. And so if you do a conformal transformation, this metric is singular, but the new will not, this will be zero. So when you do this conformal transformation, of course, the curvature of that metric is zero. So this conformal factor's issue is very important. I mean, for example, when you deal with string theory, there are many frames. You can look at it in Einstein or Weyl or string or whatever frame you like, and it's all the same issue. Is this conformal factor really there? And so again, you could take this as a, I'll explain in a little more detail about this in a moment, how there are some scenarios in which that conformal factor really does disappear. Any other questions? Okay, so I was explaining this example. We have a negative potential. The scalar field is going to slide off the hill. And the scale factor goes like a power law. In fact, I should put minus t to the p. We'll take t to be less than zero. Because what will happen is if t starts out large and negative, as I run towards t equals zero, at t equals zero, the scalar field will go to infinity, to minus infinity. Phi goes to minus infinity as t goes to zero. And as it does so, the density of the universe goes like 1 over t squared. And that goes like a. So t from here is a to the 1 over p. To the 2 over p. And so this number is huge. If c is large, this is much bigger than 1. Minus 2 over p. So the point of this is that for a very steep potential, the universe is contracting, but very, very slowly. Okay, p is an arbitrarily small power. So you're sitting here rolling down the hill, universe is collapsing, but very, very slowly. However, its density is rising as a huge power of A, much faster than matter or radiation. So you see, in such a universe, as it heads towards contraction, even if you have some matter there, you have galaxies there, you can have institutes there or people there, it wouldn't make any difference. Because as you go to the singularity, the density in the scalar field rises like such a huge power of A that it completely swamps everything else. And so the dynamical effect of the matter becomes negligible. All right, that's just the properties of a very steep exponential potential. So this actually instantly solves the flatness puzzle, okay? Because the flatness puzzle is the following, that on the right-hand side of the Friedmann equation, you have the density term, and then you have k over a squared. And the flatness puzzle is that generally this term will grow relative to, you have a flatness puzzle if this term grows relative to that one. In a contracting universe, where rho is rising like a huge power of A, this one will completely overwhelm that one. Then you sort of hit the singularity. You have to resolve the singularity. You expand again, but this time is radiation, 1 over a to the fourth. And basically, there's an asymmetry in the problem, that you gain so much in this term relative to the curvature in the contracting phase, that the universe comes out flat. So you need to go through the singularity, for sure. If you do so, this solves the flatness and the isotropy problem as well. Because again, the scalar field stress energy is actually isotropic in space. It's kinetic and potential, but those are isotropic. And they completely dominate. And so the flatness and isotropy puzzles go away. And then there was a sort of miracle, which is that you get scale invariant perturbations. Now, the history of the ekparotic model is that actually we understood this first, okay, and then we realized that the same potential solves these problems. With inflation, it's exactly the other way around. It was invented to solve these problems, and then it gave scale invariants. But so let me explain why the perturbations came out scale invariant. And again, Jean-Luc will talk much more about this in his lectures. But again, the answer is symmetry. That, again, let's start with the action. And I'm going to put the h-bar in there so that we can see, again, where it comes into the answer. So the action is I over h-bar. Integral d4x 1/2 d phi squared. And then I'm just going to put in this exponential potential like that. And I'm going to neglect gravity. OK. So the justification for that is that actually the universe is expanding, is contracting very, very slowly for the parameter h we're interested in. And so to first approximation, just treat it as if it was not contracting at all. But the scalar field is falling off the hill. If we neglect gravity, then there is a scale symmetry. It's a little bit more complicated than the one we had before. It's completely different. The scale symmetry is that if I rescale the spatial coordinates, the space-time coordinates, and I shift the scalar field, okay? So you see, if I do that, I'm left with two overall powers of lambda. Because there are two in the numerator here, two derivatives. And then I designed the shift in the scalar field so that this term will produce exactly 1 over lambda squared, like that term. And so overall, I'm left with two powers of lambda. And so I have to change h-bar too. OK, so this is not a good quantum symmetry. It's actually only a classical symmetry, because the overall scale of the action doesn't matter for classical effects. But it turns out it's just as good in terms of generating something scale invariant, as you'll see. So then we find a scaling background. So just try and solve the equations of motion for this theory to find phi of t as it falls off the hill. And the scaling background is just that phi is 2 over c log t. And you could have guessed that from the symmetry, because whatever solution you find, it better respect the symmetry of the action. And so if I rescale t by lambda, phi has to shift by this amount, and that's what the solution does. So you can sort of read off that solution by symmetry. And now we're looking for an instability. What's the instability? Well, in this case, the instability is that imagine in part of space, the scalar field was slightly ahead of where it was in neighboring regions. Okay, so slightly further down the hill. As it goes down, that's going to amplify, because this potential is getting steeper and steeper. So it will just amplify. Any deviations between neighboring points are going to be amplified as they all fall down the hill. And in fact, it's just a time delay. The instability is a time delay, delta t. So just take your background solution, replace t with t plus delta t, and expand in delta t, and you'll find you get delta phi proportional to 1 over t. So the deviation in phi that you induce with a small local time delay scales as 1 over t. So that's a pretty dramatic instability. And that will very successfully convert quantum fluctuations into classical long wavelength fluctuations. And so now we go and calculate our delta phi squared. And it's got to be proportional to h bar because it's quantum. It's the quantum expectation value. It has to have over t squared. That's because of the instability. That's how it will grow with time. All these modes grow like 1 over t. And it's got to have an integral d3k, just because you integrate over all the modes. And then it's got to be invariant under this symmetry, because that's the symmetry of the theory. So you can see the first factor is invariant, because h bar scales and t scales. The k is not invariant, because x goes like lambda x, so k goes like 1 over lambda. And so the only way to make it consistent is to have k cubed here. And so that's scale invariant. Now, there's a whole story about how such, so you have scale invariant scalar fields fluctuations. There's a whole story about how these can convert into geometry perturbations, which I haven't dealt with. Again, maybe Jean-Luc will discuss that in his talk. But what you have in essence, I'm trying to just illustrate that the essence is you have a theory with a symmetry and an instability, and that will generate scale invariants for you. So I think I'm running out of time, but I want to just mention, oh, yeah, I said I would say more about the singularity. So let me say a little bit more about the singularity. Obviously, this kind of scenario has no chance of success unless we actually can sensibly follow the universe across the singularity. Okay, we can generate scale invariants, we can solve the horizon and flatness and isotropy puzzles pretty easily. There's about the same degree of fine-tuning in this theory as there is in inflation, but we have to get through the singularity. So let me tell you about two approaches to doing that. One is extremely naive, and won't convince you, and it shouldn't convince you, but it'll be an illustration. And it's the following. What if the conformal factor required to get rid of the singularity, okay, so our singularity is in A squared, what if we can get rid of that conformal factor? What if this conformal factor arose from dimensional reduction? So I've already mentioned this. In string theory or M theory, you are dealing with the theory in higher dimensions. And the question is maybe which frame do you use? Do you use 10-dimensional frame, 10-dimensional Einstein frame? Do you use 4-dimensional, 5-dimensional? Which frame should you use? So it turns out that dimensional reduction from 5 to 4 dimensions automatically introduces a scale factor, a conformal factor, which kills the singularity, okay, in the most simple model. So let's take 5D gravity, pure gravity, and we dimensionally reduce to 4D gravity, and you get a scalar field. Okay, so that scalar field represents the size of the fifth dimension of space. And if you write down the formula for the 5D metric, it's e to the minus, so I'm going to choose units where 8 pi g is 1, Planck mass is 1, and then the 5D metric is 2/3 phi a squared, and I'm going to assume the 4D metric is a cosmology of the type we want to understand. And then we have our extra dimension, So that's the fifth dimension of space, which might be a circle. And so this is simply an expression taking you from the 5D line element to the 4D line element. This is ds4 squared. And this conformal factor comes in. The reason it comes in is you want to be in Einstein frame in 4D. You don't want any powers of any function of the scalar field in front of the Einstein, in front of the Ricci scalar in the Einstein action. So that's the very simplest Kaluza-Klein theory. Now, if I have 4D gravity in a scalar field, I can construct a cosmology, right? The cosmology amounts to the Friedmann equation, A dot over A squared is equal to 1/3, because 8 pi g is 1, times phi dot squared. And this is the kinetic energy of the scalar field that I have. So that's all I have, scale factor and scalar field. Now, then it's not hard to show that this kinetic term in conformal time goes like 1 over a to the 4th. And so a goes like tau to the a goes like tau to the half. Okay, but just from the, sorry, I should have a 1/6 here. It's 8 pi g over 3 times 1/2 phi dot squared. But from this equation, you can see immediately that A is proportional to E to the plus or minus root 1/6 phi. If we're studying a past singularity, let's say phi went to minus infinity and A is 0, then I take the plus sign. And now you see a bit of a miracle, which is that this factor in A exactly cancels this factor. So, or put differently, going to the 4D metric was singular, but the 5D metric actually doesn't have any scale factor dependence at all. This precisely cancels the A squared. And so, and the geometrically, the reason is actually very simple, that the 5D metric is equal to minus d tor squared plus dx squared. As I said, there's no scale factor. Plus tor squared d theta squared. And these two pieces of it are known as 1 plus 1 Milne universe. This is actually just flat space-time in funny coordinates. So this metric actually doesn't have any curvature. It's zero. The Riemann tensor is zero. And geometrically, for example, if I imagine theta is a circle, this is conical space-time, where the size of the circle goes like tau. And that's the singularity. So it's still singular, but zero Riemann curvature. Okay, so for this reason, actually, you know, people always say we maybe expect powers of the Riemann curvature to get rid of singularities. For example, in string theory, you get r squared and r to the fourth and so on. And many people hope that those corrections would remove singularities. But in fact, you can see they can't possibly do that because here in this space-time, the Riemann tensor is zero. And so in M theory, for example, the field equations, when there's no scalar fields around in 11 dimensions, there are no scalar fields. If you can write the field equations in terms of curvature invariance, they're no help at all. This type of singularity still occurs. So curvature is not going to make the universe bounce, but it's very, very tempting to continue through the singularity like that. You see, if I just take this metric I can just try to run tor through zero and come out the other side. And so that was actually our very naive first attempt at dealing with the singularity. Basically, all we did is we took the singularity in 4D, lifted it to 5D. Notice that the three dimensions we live in do not contract at the singularity. They actually remain spread out. This was the colliding brain picture. So the world is finite. Our world is finite, singularity. But the brains have collided. The brains are separated by the fifth dimension. You still have a singularity. You still need a string theory miracle to resolve this singularity, or some miracle to resolve the singularity. But you've removed it from the three dimensions that we live in. So the density of matter is finite at the bang and so on. So I see I've run out of time. I just want to mention our very latest work on this, which is which I was going to show you a few slides about, but I'll just refer you to it. And that is using holography to study t equals zero. Okay, so essentially you want to look at string theory on a spacetime like this, which is singular. It's as mild a singularity as you can have because the Riemann curvature is zero, but it's still singular. And you want to see if somehow the theory makes sense. And so holography, which would require a whole new lecture to tell you about, is the idea that I can describe gravity in the bulk of some spacetime, an anti-de Sitter-like spacetime, with a field theory on the boundary. In fact, it has to be a conformal field theory on the boundary. And so now, immediately in this framework, there is an obvious candidate for the scale invariance, okay? Because gravity in the bulk is dual to a conformal field theory. When you allow cosmological evolution in the bulk, so you allow the bulk to collapse to a singularity, it turns out this conformal field theory is unstable. The instability in the bulk corresponds to the conformal theory having a scalar potential that's unbounded below. It's like the ekparotic potential, but it's actually V goes like minus phi to the sixth. If we have a 4D cosmology and a 3D boundary, then we have a potential like this. Such a potential, as the field falls off the hill, automatically generates scale invariant perturbations. It's a symmetry. It's just the scale symmetry of the conformal field theory. And so this is sort of a work in progress. But I think I better end there. Thank you. Okay. To have nothing. No. That's a stepping stone. Okay? So luckily, the world is not conformally invariant. If it was conformally invariant in this picture, there wouldn't have been a big bang. Okay? So it's the breaking of conformal invariance which, in fact, causes there to be anything there at all. But the first step is to describe the nothing. And then to describe, you know, what happens at this type of singularity. Yes. You do, but you have this singularity, okay? Okay. Let me see how to. So the thing in this problem, there are many, many different points of view, okay? some of which I've mentioned. You can look at things as 4D gravity in a scalar field. You can look at things as higher dimensional theory in 5D or 10D or whatever. And you always have to get the same results, but it'll come out in a different way. the picture here, so the critical thing here is indeed to figure out what does the singularity do in terms of creating particles. And the way you study this in the holographic picture is to find a bulk metric which contains something like this. Even there, it's a bit more complicated because you have the setup we're discussing. It's really a seven sphere, and one of the seven sphere dimensions turns out to be like this Milne. So it's all a little bit more complicated, but it's sort of similar in spirit to this. But you can't answer the question directly. I mean, for example, how do I propagate a particle across this point? It's not clear. I mean, it is still singular, even though R is zero. In the dual theory, that's a quantum field theory with no gravity involved. I mean, it's a normal quantum field theory, although it has this unbounded scalar potential. Within that theory, you can compute what happens, or you try to compute what happens. Yeah. Yes. True, like a Milne universe, yeah. Yes. Okay, so I think you're right. The whole point is to calculate the particle production. we've actually done that for strings, so you can propagate strings towards the singularity, and there is a calculation you can do. I mean, there's still some assumptions. It's not complete, but you can actually compute the production of circular loops of string in such a background, and it gives a finite result. That's in a paper Malcolm Perry and myself wrote a couple of years ago. But the assumptions that are made in that, so basically the picture in that context is the following. In that context, this extra dimension was the 11th dimension, the 10th dimension of space in M theory. Now, the 10th dimension of space is a peculiar one. It's called the M-theory dimension. And so what is a fundamental string in that picture? A fundamental string is a membrane which wraps the 10th dimension of space. And that's the dimension we're imagining is the one that collapses. So the first thing is you ask, how does a string behave? How does this membrane behave between these two ends of the dimension? I'm going to pretend it's an interval instead of a circle. Just easier to do that. Okay. It can also work for a circle. But if it's an interval, you have this membrane. And then the intriguing thing is, when the two membranes collide, the effective mass per unit length of the string goes to zero, because it's just equal to the membrane tension times its length. That's the conformal symmetry. So actually, in the string theory picture, it's really obvious why conformal symmetry is restored when these brains collide. Okay, so again, you know, these are all clues. We haven't completed the story by any means, but there is a real physical mechanism why conformal symmetry is restored when the dimension collapses. So you can look at the Nambu equations, the equations for this wrapped membrane in the collapsing dimension. It turns out the solutions are actually regular across the singularity, even though the dimension disappears for a moment. The equation is actually regular. And then you can do that. You do a semi-classical calculation of the production of strings. When that happens, you get a finite answer. So now, people did not find that fully convincing for a number of reasons. What was the main reason they didn't find it convincing? It's only semi-classical. It's not a full solution of the quantum theory. And that's why we started discussing this holography picture, because it seems more complete. So the idea is that the holographic picture really is a non-perturbative definition of the full theory, not just strings, but the brains and everything. And so if you really go into satisfactorily resolve it, that's probably your best bet. And so that's a whole other story. But what I find intriguing is the suggestions of conformal symmetry at the singularity, the suggestion that gravity is dual to a scale invariant field theory, which is unstable for cosmological backgrounds, that makes scale invariant perturbations for free. And indeed, in our calculations, we do find scale invariant perturbations. They're always suppressed by a small parameter. I mean, the non-Gaussianity is suppressed. There are all kinds of nice features, but we're a long way from a complete story. But I guess the point of my lecture is to try to convey to you that it's not necessarily over and done. I mean, inflation is a great theory, a great possibility, but there are many other possibilities too. Are there any other? Yeah. Yes. No, the answer is yes. 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 So the easiest observation, there are many observations, okay? The one just around the corner is gravitational waves. So with inflation, if you have exponential expansion, you have to generate primordial gravitational waves at some level, long wave. The level can be adjusted. It's a matter of opinion, okay? So in a quadratic potential, the level is about 5% of the 5% of the CMB anisotropy would be due to those things. So it's big, and Planck could see it. Okay, so for phi squared potential, it's possible to it would be possible to see it. So that would be very spectacular. If Planck sees gravitational waves at that level, I mean, personally, I'll say that is more or less conclusive evidence that there was indeed inflation. Yeah. Unfortunately, our prediction is zero. It's not a very distinctive prediction. But, the pressure will come as experiments improve, and it goes to 5% and 1% and 0.1%. Large numbers of inflationary models will be ruled out. You'll still be left with some, so you can always design an inflationary model where basically the potential looks like this. And as you lower this height, you lower the gravitational waves. And you can design that to evade any conceivable experiment. But I think you'll be pushing the theory into a funny corner of parameter space, and gradually people will become... all the problems I referred to of the initial conditions for the scalar field being arbitrary, initial conditions on the space-time being arbitrary, of the unjustified choice of compactification, all those things are big, big, big problems. And so maybe some way out will be found. Second observation, I haven't talked about this at all, but the mere fact of lambda. When you start resolving a singularity, then you open the possibility to a cyclical universe, and then it's possible for lambda to relax over many cycles of evolution of the universe. So you can now have natural mechanisms for lambda decreasing to a tiny value and staying there for an exponentially long time. And so it says whole new ways of approaching the cosmological constant problem, the coincidence problem of the matter density and lambda, why lambda is 10 to the minus 120, all kinds of avenues open up, which I haven't talked about. Yes. It's not changing. Well, in this model, it's essential, if it is going to be cyclical, it's essential the dark energy can decay. And so at some level, omega is not minus 1. W is not minus 1. It has to decay. That's a free parameter. We can make W as close to minus 1 as we like, and the model is still fine. And so we can avoid any conceivable observation. Second observation, axions. It's very interesting. Okay, so axions, if F axion, which is the VEV of the field that governs the axion, is very large, then in a typical cosmology, the dark matter density is enormous. Okay, and that would be ruled out. Basically, because the typical cosmology, you throw some random initial condition for this field as a tilted circle, and you just pick a random point on that field, for that field, and you typically get a huge value of the dark matter density. So So then people start appealing to anthropics, et cetera, et cetera. It's quite possible that we will say we measure an axion. We find it has a huge F axion. And then we determine that the initial conditions were well below the anthropic, nothing to do with anthropic. Then actually that would be an evidence in favor of a universe before, during which this thing relaxed towards zero. So, you know, people are now scanning for axions. They may find one, if they're lucky. If we are lucky, it'll be a very large F axion, and that will land the standard cosmology in a fine-tuning problem. Whereas for us, we would expect these very slowly evolving fields to all be at their minimum, because if the universe has been much older, you know, than 14 billion years, things should have really settled down. So there are definitely things that can be done. But, you know, I have to say that the mathematical aspects of this are the most important at the moment. The observational ones, you know, we hope will come later. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.